Chapter 2 The Aristocracy of Pull. The calendar in the sky beyond the window of her office said September 2nd. Dagny leaned wearily across her desk. The first light to snap on at the approach of dusk was always the ray that hit the calendar. When the white glowing page appeared above the roofs, it blurred the city, hastening the darkness. She had looked at that distant page every evening of the months behind her. Your days are numbered, it had seemed to say, as if it were marking a progression toward something it knew but she didn't. Once it had clocked her race to build the John Galt line. Now it was clocking her race against an unknown destroyer. One by one, the men who had built new towns in Colorado had departed into some silent unknown from which no voice or person had yet returned. The towns they had left were dying. Some of the factories they built had remained ownerless and locked. Others had been seized by the local authorities. The machines in both stood still. She had felt as if a dark map of Colorado were spread before her like a traffic control panel, with a few lights scattered through its mountains. One after another, the lights had gone out. One after another, the men had vanished. There had been a pattern about it, which she felt but could not define. She had become able to predict almost with certainty who would go next and when. She was unable to grasp the why. Of the men who had once greeted her descent from the cab of an engine on the platform of Wyatt Junction, only Ted Nielsen was left, still running the plant of Nielsen Motors. "Ted, you won't be the next one to go?" she had asked him on his recent visit to New York. She had asked it, trying to smile. He had answered grimly, "I hope not." "What do you mean you hope? Aren't you sure?" he had said slowly, heavily. "Dagny, I've always thought that I'd rather die than stop working. And so did the men who are gone. It seems impossible to me that I could ever want to quit. But a year ago it seemed impossible that they ever could. Those men were my friends. They knew what their going would do to us, the survivors. They would not have gone like that without a word, leaving to us the added terror of the inexplicable, unless they had some reason of supreme importance. A month ago, Roger Marsh of Marsh Electric told me he'd have himself chained to his desk, so that he wouldn't be able to leave it, no matter what ghastly temptation struck him. He was furious with anger at the men who'd left. He swore to me that he'd never do it. And if it's something that I can't resist, he said, I swear that I'll keep enough of my mind to leave you a letter and give you some hint of what it is so that you won't have to rack your brain in the kind of dread we're both feeling now. That's what he swore. 2 weeks ago he went. He left me no letter. Dagny, I can't tell what I'll do when I see it. Whatever it was that they saw when they went. It seemed to her that some destroyer was moving soundlessly through the country, and the lights were dying at his touch. Someone, she thought bitterly, who had reversed the principle of the 20th century motor, and was now turning kinetic energy into static. That was the enemy, she thought, as she sat at her desk in the gathering twilight, with whom she was running a race. The monthly report from Quentin Daniels lay on her desk. She could not be certain as yet that Daniels would solve the secret of the motor, but the destroyer, she thought, was moving swiftly, surely, at an ever-accelerating tempo. She wondered whether, by the time she rebuilt the motor, there would be any world left to use it. She had liked Quentin Daniels from the moment he entered her office on their first interview. He was a lanky man in his early 30s, with a homely, angular face and an attractive smile. A hint of the smile remained in his features at all times, particularly when he listened. It was a look of good-natured amusement, as if he were swiftly and patiently discarding the irrelevant in the words he heard, and going straight to the point a moment ahead of the speaker. "Why did you refuse to work for Dr. Stadler?" she asked. The hint of his smile grew harder and more stressed. This was as near as he came to showing an emotion. The emotion was anger. But he answered in his even, unhurried drawl, "You know, Dr. Stadler once said that the first word of free scientific inquiry was redundant. He seems to have forgotten it." "Well, I'll just say that governmental scientific inquiry is a contradiction in terms." She asked him what position he held at the Utah Institute of Technology. "Night watchman," he answered. What? She gasped. Night watchman, he repeated politely, as if she had not caught the words, as if there were no cause for astonishment. Under her questioning, he explained that he did not like any of the scientific foundations left in existence, that he would have liked a job in the research laboratory of some big industrial concern, but which one of them can afford to undertake any long-range work nowadays? And why should they? So when the Utah Institute of Technology was closed for lack of funds, he had remained there as night watchman and sole inhabitant of the place. The salary was sufficient to pay for his needs, and the Institute's laboratory was there intact for his own private, undisturbed use.
So you're doing research work of your own?
That's right.
For what purpose?
For my own pleasure. What do you intend to do if you discover something of scientific importance or commercial value? Do you intend to put it to some public use?
I don't know.
I don't think so. Haven't you any desire to be of service to humanity? I don't talk that kind of language, Miss Taggart.
I don't think you do either.
She laughed. I think we'll get along together, you and I.
We will.
When she had told him the story of the motor, when he had studied the manuscript, he made no comment, but merely said that he would take the job on any terms she named. She asked him to choose his own terms. She protested in astonishment against the low monthly salary he quoted. Miss Taggart, he said, if there's something that I won't take, it's something for nothing. I don't know how long you might have to pay me, or whether you'll get anything at all in return. I'll gamble on my own mind. I won't let anybody else do it. I don't collect for an intention, but I sure do intend to collect for goods delivered. If I succeed, that's when I'll skin you alive, because what I want then is a percentage, and it's going to be high, but it's going to be worth your while. When he named the percentage he wanted, she laughed. That is skinning me alive. And it will be worth my while. Okay. They agreed that it was to be her private project and that he was to be her private employee. Neither of them wanted to have to deal with the interference of the Taggart Research Department. He asked to remain in Utah in his post of watchman, where he had all the laboratory equipment and all the privacy he needed. The project was to remain confidential between them until and unless he succeeded. Miss Taggart, he said in conclusion, I don't know how many years it will take me to solve this, if ever, but I know that if I spend the rest of my life on it and succeed, I will die satisfied. He added, there's only one thing that I want more than to solve it. It's to meet the man who has. Once a month since his return to Utah, she had sent him a check, and he had sent her a report on his work. It was too early to hope, but his reports were the only bright points in the stagnant fog of her days in the office. She raised her head as she finished reading his pages. The calendar in the distance said September 2nd. The lights of the city had grown beneath it, spreading and glittering. She thought of Reardon. She wished he were in the city. She wished she would see him tonight. Then, noticing the date, she remembered suddenly that she had to rush home to dress, because she had to attend Jim's wedding tonight. She had not seen Jim outside the office for over a year. She had not met his fiancée, but she had read enough about the engagement in the newspapers. She rose from her desk in wearily distasteful resignation. It seemed easier to attend the wedding than to bother explaining her absence afterwards. She was hurrying across the concourse of the terminal when she heard a voice calling, Miss Taggart, with a strange note of urgency and reluctance together. It stopped her abruptly. She took a few seconds to realize that it was the old man at the cigar stand who had called. I've been waiting to catch sight of you for days, Miss Taggart. I've been extremely anxious to speak to you. There was an odd expression on his face, the look of an effort not to look frightened. I'm sorry, she said, smiling. I've been rushing in and out of the building all week and didn't have time to stop. He did not smile. Miss Taggart, that cigarette with the dollar sign that you gave me some months ago, where did you get it? She stood still for a moment. I'm afraid that's a long, complicated story, she answered. Have you any way of getting in touch with the person who gave it to you?
I suppose so. Though I'm not too sure. Why?
Would he tell you where he got it?
I don't know. What makes you suspect that he wouldn't?
He hesitated, then asked,
Miss Taggart, what do you do when you have to tell someone something which you know to be impossible?
She chuckled.